Okay, so last class we saw the state update rule, which is both a practical thing for you to know in the sense of if you want to describe experiments, but it's also something that is the cause of some kind of controversy in our understanding of quantum mechanics. So just recall what we learned kind of operationally, which is given some PVM measurement, which is a set of projectors that are orthonormal and sum to identity. And we have some input preparation rho describing our state. And then we have two possible cases. One is that we condition on some observed outcome k. This is the selective situation. And then our input state rho gets updated to rho prime, which is just pk rho pk divided and renormalized. And the other possibility is that we don't condition on the outcome for whatever reason. And then rho gets updated to rho prime, which is just a sum over each of these cases. Yeah.
Would we be able to talk about why the state update rule has that form, why projector, rho projector? I mean, we talked about the denominator being a normalization factor, but why is the numerator, why does it have that form? Before we saw, I guess the following an ideal projective measurement that you just need to play projector density operator. You just need one projector there, and you take the trace of that. Why? What do the two projector operators do?
I think part of the reasons. I mean, if you have a state psi, okay, so. Given some vector psi, which is in some Hilbert space, then if we have a this is a vector in the Hilbert space CD. So then if we want to project out some components, then we use a projector pk psi, and so let's expand psi on a basis that includes pk, sum over L, alpha L, phi L, and then what pk would do is it would have sum over L, alpha L, pk acting on phi L, and then if phi L is in the plus one eigenspace of pk, then pk phi L is equal to phi L. And otherwise, it's zero. Well, otherwise, by otherwise, I mean it has no support in the plus one eigenspace of PK. Then you get zero. So we'll just truncate this sum to those terms that are just like if you have a vector in three dimensions, you project onto a plane, you throw away the components that aren't in the subspace associated with the projector. But now for a density operator, in general, it's going to be a state of this form. Right, because rho is now a linear operator on CD. So if we have a general preparation, it's not a vector, and you can't be represented by a vector anymore. Vectors correspond to complete or maximal information about the preparation, whereas a density operator can correspond to either maximal information or submaximal information, and it has the following form. So what you do is you need a pk to act both on the left and on the right. I mean, it's hard to answer the question why, because it's not clear at what level to answer that question, but it's the appropriate thing to, maybe another way to think about it, which would be good for you guys to know. So the set of density operators itself forms a Hilbert space So one can have a, so this Hilbert space is the Hilbert space CD squared with inner product AB equal to trace of A dagger B. And a projector with the PK on each side is the appropriate way to represent a projection on this Hilbert space. That's another level of answer. I mean, another answer is that it works. I mean, this is the object which removes support of the density operator from pieces of the Hilbert space that shouldn't be there. I hope, did any of those answers help? Oh, I see where you're going with that. Right. Because of this trick. I showed this last class. The point is that, okay, so this is actually the answer to your question then. The answer is that trace of PK rho PK is equal to the trace of PK squared rho via the cyclic property of the trace, and PK squared is equal to PK via the fact that it's a projector. So if you check your notes, I mentioned that when we discussed this denominator last class. So that's why you can either write it this way or this way. It's a matter of taste. And so this is the probability of outcome K, which can be written equivalently this way. And so then the argument of this is what appears in the numerator. Yes?
So the Hilbert space of operators that you wrote at CD squared, mm-hmm. if I restrict myself to just density operators, which happen to be Hermitian operators, then I don't see it's why it would be d squared. Also, the Schmidt-Hilbert inner product, the dagger is sort of unnecessary, so it must be more general.
Yeah, so actually, you can actually construct a set of linear operators that aren't density operators. So this Hilbert space, you can find a basis in terms of density operators. So in fact, it's the full space of linear operators. So let me just write it here. The space of linear operators self-forms a Hilbert space, and the inner product is of this form, where A and B are elements of this larger Hilbert space. So basically what you have is this correspondence. And it turns out that it's sufficient also to have a basis of Hermitian operators. And the fact that you can have the field is complex. So the fact that you can add complex coefficients allows you to generate non-Hermitian operators from linear combinations of Hermitian operators. But actually I think this more directly answers your question. So basically what I wanted to tell you today is how we know based on empirical constraints that these rules have to be true. In other words, we have to, in order to match the predictions of experiments with the predictions of quantum mechanics, I mean the results of experiments with the predictions of quantum mechanics, we know that these are correct. But here's the problem. The problem is that rule 2 follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics, rule 1 doesn't. You're nodding because you know that's true, or you're nodding because you want to hear more? So this is kind of the astounding thing. So the point is that this was pointed out by von Neumann. So von Neumann recognized that process 2 follows from the axiom of quantum mechanics, but process one does not. So here then process one is then has all these names like collapse or the projection postulate. So let me show you that how process two follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics. So we'll do an abstract model of measurement. So we have a Hilbert space, which consists of a system and an apparatus. And then we have some vector in the system Hilbert space and some apparatus vector. So we're describing the apparatus as a quantum device and assigning a quantum state to it. For simplicity, we're assuming these states are pure. So we have some system observable A. And for simplicity, let me assume that we just have a non-degenerate observable. So I'll just call these this form. Now the measurement interaction is described by some unitary operator. We don't have to worry about what kind of Hamiltonian will generate this interaction, but just that we know it's a physical process, so it has to be described by a unitary. And so the measurement interaction corresponds to evolving mu psi phi. Now we want a useful measurement. So the useful measurement has to be able to distinguish distinct input states. So let phi be the initial ready state of the apparatus. Then we expect U acting on some input state AL of the system times phi to be mapped to AL tensor. Some distinct alpha L. So these are essentially the index L denotes distinct say pointer positions on the apparatus. Again, you have this idea that you have some pointer, and this would be your index, you know, L equals 0, all the way to L equals capital L, and you would have a pointer that would tell you which L you got. So the idea is we associate outcomes of the pointer with input states of the system. Now, given some input state psi, which is a linear combination of the eigenstates of the observable, A, then the bilinearity we get that U acting on psi tensor phi must be equal to a sum over L CL AL tensor alpha L. Equation 1. So equation 1 corresponds to an entangled state of the system and apparatus. Which is a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct configurations. So at this intermediate stage, you might notice that this is analogous to the Schrodinger's cat scenario, right? So in the Schrodinger's cat picture, one has an atom decays or does not decay. It's a coherent superposition of decaying and not decaying. And the cat plays the role of the pointer. And if it decays, then the cat is killed, and so the pointer is in one position. And if it doesn't decay, then the cat is not killed, and the pointer is in another position. And so Schrodinger's cat paradox is this paradox of the fact that one has a macroscopic superposition of a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct physical configurations. So whether it's a pointer or a cat is just a matter of marketing. The same idea. Now the point is, if we partial trace trace out the apparatus, over the apparatus Hilbert space, then we get a description of the system. So rho of the system is equal to the trace over the apparatus of this final state, which let me just call it chi. Let me define this state to be chi. And what you find is that chi is going to correspond to the sum over L CL squared AL AL, where CL CL is equal to the inner product of AL with psi, so therefore CL squared is equal to trace of AL AL against psi psi, which is equal to the probability of L given psi. Sorry, I want this expression to look like condition two, which right. So if we just let in condition in case two, we have, I guess k is my index. All right, well, this should be pretty clear, but here, let me just write it out. So rho s is equal to a sum, let's just change the dummy index to k, and we have, maybe one of you guys can see this better. Do you see the identification? So that's something missing for me. You should have a incoherent sum over the projectors. Well, the ALs are the PKs, that's for sure. Oh, right. So if we write this out as, AK, AK, rho, AK, AK, then we recognize this as being probability of K given psi, and then we have left over this projector. So this is equal to sum over K of the probability probability of k given psi times ak this piece and this piece. That, so here we've used, So Nicole, this might help answer your question as well. So by looking at this model of measurement, we see that what we get out as the final state by looking at the unitary evolution, that a unitary evolution associated with this measurement process, and then if we remove the description of the apparatus, so we take no information from it and just want to describe the system, then we're left with this state here by evaluating this partial trace. And then the formula prescribed by case two is exactly the same thing. Yes?
So what is rho on the first line? On the right-hand side?
Here?
Yeah, on the right-hand side.
So yeah, actually I should use a heading. So using using the rule from case two, so this is rho s. Rho s is after the measurement. So here, rho s here is my state after the measurement, and according to rule two, my state after the measurement should be a sum over k pk rho pk. So what I'm doing here, let me just step back and make sure everyone understands. So I gave you the prescription as just an abstract rule to follow. And now I'm saying, well, let's look at the most general possible description of a measurement using quantum mechanics. And you know, we assume the unitary operator has to satisfy these properties. This means that the interaction actually is doing the measurement. So this is a faithful measurement condition. And then we find if we just describe the system by using the partial trace, then we're left, we get this state. So this is implied by, so this is implied by our unitary description of measurement. Of the measurement process. So our unitary description of the measurement process tells us the final state should have this form. And using, instead if we use the rule from case two, the state should be in this form. And now I've just showed you that they're the same.
So sorry, what I'm not understanding, you wrote something, a bracket, and you identified part of that expression as probability of k conditional on psi.
Yeah, so here rho is equal to I see. That's my problem. I used
chi
here.
Sums.
Right? So chi. What do you mean there's two sums? So there's a sum over k.
Right.
This is a projector onto k.
Right.
This is a projector onto k.
Right.
This is the input state.
Okay.
So notice that, So can I use the word psi? Yeah, so conditioned on, here if I use rule two, then I just say, okay, well my input state is psi, my measurement is a measurement of these projectors. So we're contrasting this derivation with just applying directly rule two, where this is my measurement, this is my input state. And then you recognize this as the Born rule, right? Because this is equal to trace of AK psi psi. How many of you feel like this is crystal clear? Only a few of you? Okay. Well, let's ask some questions then. Yes?
What is the unitary operator there?
This unitary operator?
Yeah, it should be a matrix. It's a unitary matrix?
I don't kind of understand. Yeah, why do you operate by unitary operator?
Well, because what's our axiom three was that any transformation can be described by a unitary operator. So we have to use unitary operator to describe transformations because quantum mechanics tells us that's the appropriate thing to use. But then the question is, different unitaries have different properties. So now we picked a unitary from all the possible unitaries that has the following property. Given input state AL of the system, it pushes the pointer state to a state alpha L. So let's think about, where have you seen this before? When we looked at the Stern-Gerlach apparatus, right? So the Stern-Gerlach magnet, its job was to create a correlation between the spin degree of freedom, which in this case is our system, and the spatial degree of freedom, which in this case is our apparatus. So what it does is it takes input state spin up, tensor some spatial state, omega, so this is the spatial wave function. And what it does is it says, well, if the input state is spin up, then I want the output state to be propagating in the plus z direction. And I also want the Stern-Gerlach magnet. The reason why the Stern-Gerlach magnet is used is because it has the nice property that it carries out this transformation for you. This should be spin up, and this is spin down. And what it does is it rotates the direction of, well, rotates in the quantum sense, but in the physical sense, it deviates the input beam to have a downward deflection. So now this state represents a spatial wave function that's propagating along the negative z-axis. So the reason why the Stern-Gerlach magnet is a useful way to measure spin as opposed to anything else is because it specifically does this for you. So now we can write down the Hamiltonian for the Stern-Gerlach magnet and see that it generates a unitary which has exactly this action. And so now we're generalizing that concept to an arbitrary number of states. So now we can have a spin 10 object, and this would create a degree of deflection that's proportional to the spin component. So you'd have 10 different spatial directions, or 10 different, you know, degrees of 10 different momentum values in the positive and negative z directions. And so the idea is, Any interaction is described by a unitary. So that you should accept because of axiom three. But now we want to design a unitary. If we're designing a device which is a faithful measurement device, then it must, to be a good measurement device, it must give us this. It must give us, and in fact, I haven't fully specified this, so thank you for your question. Not only do you want this to be true, what more do you want to be true about the alpha L's? So that you can tell for sure which alpha L value you got. Exactly. We also want alpha L prime to be equal to delta L L prime. And that means they'll be distinguishable. I mean, if it only moves the pointer by so little that you can't actually resolve the difference in the pointer positions, you haven't designed your measurement interaction very well. That's to be designed well enough that the distinct values of L are associated with visibly distinct directions. Just like if the Stern-Gerlach magnet isn't designed very well and the amount of kick you get is too small, you might not be able to tell the spatial direction, and so you won't be able to infer the polarization or the spin. Similarly here, if you can't distinguish the different pointer positions, then you won't be able to infer which state of the observable A. So think of A as measuring some property of the system like angular momentum or these could be the energy levels, atomic energy levels. You have some atom that's prepared in some atomic energy level and you don't know which one. And so you want some interaction which is going to correlate the atomic energy level with some observable property of a pointer, And you say, aha, well, that atom you gave me was prepared in the S equals zero eigenstate, or it was prepared in the P equals, or the P eigenstate. So the distinct eigenstates of some observable be correlated with distinct states of some macroscopic device which you can read out. This could be a current on a wire, or a position of a pointer, or a cat that's either alive or dead. And then by directly reading out the macroscopic object, you infer some property about the microscopic object. So this is all fine and good, but now the point is, the input state doesn't need to be an eigenstate of this operator A. It could be a linear combination, a coherent superposition of these eigenstates. Then what you will get is you will, when you repeat the experiment with the same input state, sometimes we get the pointer pointing here, and sometimes we get the pointer pointing there, and the probability of finding a different pointer position is given by this. This is the probability of the distinct pointer positions. But here now we're not interested in analyzing Born rule. We're interested in understanding, once we've performed the measurement interaction, how do we describe the system afterwards? And so if this was the process by which we measure the system, if we repeat, now there's two things you can do. One is you can just repeat the experiment thousands of times with the same input states and collect statistics to know what these probabilities are. The other thing you can do is you can do the experiment once, and you get some outcome, and you want to describe the state afterwards. And then there's two different scenarios in that. One is that you know what the outcome was, and you want to describe the state given that you saw the outcome, you saw the position of the pointer. And the other situation is you don't observe the pointer position, you just want to describe the state irrespective of the outcome you got. And that's the situation I'm describing now, and I'm showing you that rule I wrote down, which Nicole was spared a question, well, why that form? Well, I tried to give a mathematical answer, but now I'm kind of realizing the better answer is this physical answer. Well, let's analyze how it works and see that that is, in fact, the rule you have to assign to describe what's going on. Case two. Yes, Deborah?
So if we do observe the state, then case two is not valid.
By observe the state, you mean observe the outcome?
Outcome.
Yes, if you observe the outcome, then case two is not a good description anymore.
So the collapse function is given.
So right. So if you want, if you observe the outcome, then you can't use rule two. You have to use rule one. So what I showed you is that rule two follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics. And the complementary part of this discussion is to convince you that rule one does not follow from the axioms of quantum mechanics. So I think at least two of you were in USQIP. One of you and the other one's missing today, where I gave some preview of this kind of an argument, condensed, so I don't know how easy it was to get things out of it, but.
So I have a question.
Please.
So why is it why is the initial state constructed in this form and not in psi tensor product phi and not in the form of density operator? Because by doing so, then you are restricting that the macroscopic system be that you are saying that it can be described in a quantum mechanical way, which then would generate some kind of Schrodinger cat's dilemma, right? But why is it not in terms of rho A tensor rho B? Why is it in terms
of... Well, in fact, a more general state would be...
Yeah, a mixed...
Some, not only not a separable
some
state,
it,
but
yeah.
some kind of...
Yeah.
Okay, so let's think about what's going on here. So part of your answer... So first of all, if the state of your measurement device was correlated with the input state of your system, then you don't have a very good measurement device. So that's a scenario which can happen, but doesn't correspond to good measurement devices. So I want my measurement device to be independent of my preparation, first of all. So I'm
maybe you can think about that a bit, but certainly the paradigmatic scenario is that I assign states to different systems that haven't interacted, and certainly if hope you can accept that. Now the question is, why not use mixed states? Well, the only reason I didn't use mixed states is just because, first of all, I could use mixed states, and the same conclusion would follow. So maybe that's actually a good exercise, is to go through that argument. I mean, basically, what you end up doing is a lot of notational clumsiness to reach the same conclusion. So the one answer to your question is, by looking at pure states, we get the simplest expression of the idea, and mixed states just makes it noisy or messy. I don't understand which conclusion it is that you suspect might not hold if the states were mixed. I mean, first of all, let me just give you some flattery and point out there are scientific papers written on that subject in like the 1970s saying that, oh, we can avoid all these problems if we just use mixed states. So it's a good idea, but it doesn't work. Using mixed states, maybe I should let you repeat your question, but proving that case two follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics is somehow not surprising. I mean, you would expect that to be true. It's not an alarming result in any way. The alarming result is that case one doesn't follow from the axioms of quantum mechanics. And that's the result which you might want to say, maybe if we add mixed states to the description, we allow the apparatus to be a mixed state, and if we allow the initial input state of the system to be a mixed state, then we can avoid that conclusion about case one. But first of all, let me just say this. If the apparatus is in a mixed state, what that's going to mean is that the apparatus isn't going to work very well. So if I have a good apparatus, every time I put in the state, let's set L equals 0, every time I put in the state A0, I want to be able to see outcome alpha 0, right? So if I have a good apparatus, it reliably produces the pointer position consistent with the calibration state I input to the device. If I input state A0 and I don't get outcome alpha 0, I get outcome alpha 1, that means I have a measurement device that performs inefficiently. It doesn't always tell me the right answer. So that happens all the time in the real world, but all it does is just kind of makes the analysis more complicated. So in principle, one can build a device which is perfectly efficient, and so that's the case I'm considering. Now, if the input state psi was a mixed state, then I agree, you aren't left with a macroscopically distinct superposition, and that's fine. But if the input state is a pure state, then you are left with a macroscopic superposition. And that's the interesting scenario, so that's why we consider it. So I hope some of that information will address your concerns, and we might look at that as a kind of exercise.
So some people claim that it's taking into account decoherence that actually leads to result number one.
Yeah, so that's basically not true. Taking into account decoherence gives you result two. So this is worked out in, so you guys have these theory of measurement course notes, right? I think it's chapter 5 of my lecture notes.
Is that the open systems one?
No.
Right, the other one.
Yeah, so they have this. So it's discussed in there, but actually this is exactly where I want to go to the subject of decoherence. So I keep talking about this scenario where you do a measurement and you don't see the outcome. And you're thinking, well, that sounds kind of contrived. Like, how often is that going to happen, that I do a measurement and I don't see the outcome? The whole point of the measurement is to see the outcome. Well, the point is,
instead of thinking of system HA as a measurement apparatus, now let's consider system HA to be, like I mentioned last week, just some stray dust particle that interacts with your system. So you think you've created a vacuum, and you have some nice system described by the pure state of psi, which is maybe some coherent superposition over different eigenstates of some energy eigenstates or something. And then all of a sudden, unknown to you, your system, your electrons, say, interacts with the dust particle. So if we imagine, by which I really just mean consider, HA not as a measurement apparatus, but instead as some degree of freedom of the environment surrounding the system, for example, a dust particle, which gets scattered into distinct directions alpha L depending on the system states AL as above. Then we have a model of decoherence, a model for environmental decoherence. So in particular, this is a scenario where you wouldn't know the outcome of the measurement. So the idea is you think of the interaction between the electron and the dust particle. You can call it a measurement interaction, or I use scare quotes because it's the point is that the mathematical model of that stray interaction satisfies same kinds of properties that an measurement apparatus would satisfy. So I'm calling it a measurement just in that sense, not in the sense that it's an actual measurement. And the point is, if the dust particle gets scattered, if the dust particle now gets scattered up, if the system state is some state A1, and the dust particle gets scattered down, if the system state is some state A2, then we will have this same situation, but now you're still just you put your electron in a box, you preserve it in a coherent superposition, you give it to your friend and say, aha, this is a coherent superposition of this form, here are the coefficients. Then your friend goes to measure and says, hey, if you gave me this state, then I'm promised that if I perform the following measurements, I should get outcome such and such with probability 1. I performed that measurement and I didn't get that outcome. So you lied to me. You didn't give me that coherent superposition. You'd say, oh, well, I've had this problem where once in a while I don't create a perfect vacuum, and there's dust particles in the box, And then what happens is, if you just measure the electron and you don't notice the dust particle, you're tracing out the dust particle, and then you're left in this mixed state, which is now an incoherent superposition over the different AL states. And now, just there's one piece of that which might not be crystal clear to you, which is remember that like the SX, if I have a coherent superposition of zero, what do you call it, this, of plus one plus minus one, let me do it this way, plus a half and minus a half over square root of two is the input state, where this is the plus one eigenstate of SZ, and this is the minus one eigenstate of SZ. This is called the plus state because it's an eigenstate of SX. Well, I guess it'd be h bar over 2. Right, so this is the plus 1 half eigenstate of SX. So if you tell me, you give me this coherent superposition, I can be certain, if you lied to me, by measuring SX, and I should always get the plus a half outcome. If I get the plus a half outcome, I have no reason to suspect you. If I get the minus one half outcome, which is orthogonal to this state, then I know for sure you didn't provide me with this state. If instead you were given the mixed state, rho, which instead of a coherent superposition is a mixture of minus a half, minus a half over 2, and I measure SX on it, 50% of the time I'll get plus a half, and 50% of the time I'll get minus a half. So decoherence takes you from, sorry, I'm writing sloppily now. Decoherence takes you from this coherent superposition to this mixture, and one can detect that, at least on average, via measuring, say, the SX observable. And so, so now here's why building quantum devices is hard, because you want to use the coherence of quantum mechanics to achieve certain tasks. But any interactions with other systems will decohere if you don't know about that interaction or don't control it, you will create a decoherent state, a mixed state. And so this is kind of the main reason why building a quantum computer is hard, because coherence is fragile, and if you try and create scores of systems that are interacting in some controlled way and trying to keep that coherent in spite of all the possible ways in which stray systems can interact, that's a very challenging problem. Yes?
How come only if we consider the apparatus not as a measurement apparatus do we have a model for environmental decoherence? It looks like this is the same as the situation previously, except we're just saying that the apparatus is something physically different. Why should this physical difference cause us to label this decoherence and not the previous situation decoherence? Or am I just misreading this?
No, it's fine. It's fine. You can say that the apparatus decoheres the system when you don't observe the outcome. But if you do observe the outcome, then you know what the state of the system is. So it's just a terminology thing. It depends on context. Really, the language is not about the mathematical model, but about the context. The context in which you're using the mathematical model. So you're correct in realizing there's just a terminological distinction here, which is why I didn't have to repeat the equations, by the way. Yeah.
I want to distinguish what does mathematical mean, the measurement with knowing the outcome and without knowing the outcome, mathematical.
Between knowing and not knowing?
Yes.
It's this, case one and case two.
Yeah. That's a rule, right?
Right. So what I showed you here is that if you don't watch the outcome, then you get case two.
I mean, in all those kind of mathematical manipulations, where is the, you said, I mean, the you don't know the outcome lies in which line. Because all this is say that if you do not know the outcome, you finally reach the rule two, right?
Right.
But I mean, all these derivations, which part make use of the fact that you don't know the outcome?
Oh, the trace, the partial trace. So if I have two systems, A and B, and I can be describing, say, the spin degree of freedom of the electron and the spatial degree of freedom of the electron, if I just measure the spin degree of freedom, then the appropriate way to do that is to trace out the spatial degree of freedom. So the piece of knowledge, I don't observe the apparatus, is mathematically represented by throwing away that part of the state via the partial trace. And remember I proved to you that this was the appropriate way to ignore the system by showing that if I just measured an observable, if I have a state chi, and I just want to know the probability of outcome L on the system, that would be the same as taking the trace of AL, AL, tensor identity, which means measure nothing about the second system. Measure nothing about the apparatus. Am I calling it chi or psi in this context? Chi, right? So this measurement operator means measure something about the system, measure nothing about the apparatus. Measure something about the electron, measure nothing about the dust particle. And that's equivalent to the trace of AL, AL, tensor rho S, where rho S is equal to trace of A, chi, chi. So yeah, so the piece of ignoring the apparatus corresponds to putting an identity operator in this measurement. And that corresponds to the partial trace. So thanks for that question. So now just give me, give me 10 seconds to remember how to prove to you that case one can't be deduced. I mean, there's lots of ways to do it. I want to remember kind of a nice tight description here in my notes. Okay, so in deriving case two, I guess, in deriving case two, we've shown what the final state is under the measurement interaction, which is this. So now what we can do is we can make this slightly more general. And so the most general scenario, is that we have a system state psi, an apparatus state phi, and some any other properties of the universe. Which we'll put in the state here, omega. All right, so now our measurement apparatus is, we want the measurement apparatus to interact with these guys and to create a linear superposition called alpha L, yes. And now in general, omega can be affected by this process. So we'll give it a prime. So omega goes to omega prime. But case one, let me wrap up, requires the output state to be drawn from the set, to be drawn from the set AK. So it's some pure state. Given outcome K, but when we trace out the other degrees of freedom of the environment, we're left with, and we can trace out the apparatus as well, we're left with the output state of the system is equal to a mixture of those possibilities. So now here's the point. Suppose I observe outcome k equals 7. Then I expect the output state to be A7. But a unitary description of the system plus the apparatus plus me and all the dust particles and everything else in the universe, including all of you, suggests that the output state should be this mixed state, which includes outcome 7 and all the other outcomes. So I need some way to take this, I need some way to take this mixture, which is predicted by the unitary evolution, and just pick out one of these guys. And unitary evolution doesn't provide that. You can see it right away from the fact that these outcomes are indeterministic, whereas unitary evolution is a linear evolution, which is deterministic. So the state I get out is determined, but yet I have a unique outcome associated with the event itself. So here I should wrap up. I've already gone over time. So the upshot of this, and von Neumann spent at least dozens of pages in his book kind of pining, or not pining, but troubled by the fact that it was so difficult to make sense of. We know we need case one in practice, but yet we can't derive it from the axioms. So he supposed that case one was an additional axiom, an additional postulate called the projection postulate, and then was troubled by the fact that when is it appropriate for the physical process one to occur, which is the collapse, versus the normal situation, which is unitary evolution, that leads to case two. So next class, we can take up that topic a bit. Well, I'll let you ponder it over the course of the evening or the day.